Welcome to the GIST edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the gastrointestinal stromal tumor community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, contributing writer for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here in Wayne, New Jersey with Peter Knox, Senior Director of Research at the LifeRaft Group, the leading patient advocacy organization for people with gastrointestinal stromal tumor, known as GIST. Peter has a master's degree in public policy, concentrating in health policy and quantitative methods. He's been with the LifeRaft Group for the past 10 years. And we're here, of course, to talk about GIST. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Larry. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Nice to be here. Could you talk a little about the disease, what it is, how it was diagnosed, and just in general, what it's like for people who have GIST?
Absolutely, thank you. So GIST, or gastrointestinal stromal tumor, is a sarcoma, which is, you know, as I'm sure our readers know, a rarer form of cancer. It's most commonly found in the gastrointestinal tract, which goes from the salivary glands all the way out through the rectum. Occasionally, you see what we call EGIST outside of the gastrointestinal tract, but the large majority of them are there. Again, it's a sarcoma, so smooth tissue is what we're talking about here. Among sarcomas, which represent 1% of all cancers, GIST is the most common. We think that it is between, or approximately 5,000 newly diagnosed patients in the United States every year, but that number just comes from a projection from a study, so take it for what you would like. In terms of presentation, most patients will end up in the emergency room with some type of gastrointestinal distress, often a feeling of fullness, inability to have bowel movements, things like that, which, as you can imagine, can be thought of as many possibilities. Then when they get there, what happens is usually you end up with a CT scan and they find a mass of some type. Then eventually that mass is sent to a pathology lab where it is tested and found to have GIST. Many of our patients will comment that they didn't even know they had cancer and they were told to make a follow-up appointment with an oncologist. So it's interesting in its presentation. What's also very interesting about GIST and how it kind of serves as a model for other cancers is now it's very common to hear about cancers not being classified by location, but instead by mutation, the actual biological mutation in the genes. This is something that's been happening with GIST since the very beginning. When Gleevec was approved, back in the early 2000s, it was actually approved for KIT mutant GIST, which KIT is a protein in a gene that's expressed. Our patients often are, most common patients are exon 11 or exon 9, and those are mutations in KIT. Since then, many other mutations have been found. There was always PDGFRA. But as we've gone forward, I've been, like I said, with the LifeRaft for about 10 years. During that time, many new mutations have been found. And luckily, in the very beginning, many of the medications were pan-TKI, as we say, where they were designed to hit various targets. We've started to see in the last generation of drugs approved that they're very specific. They're targeted to these actual submutations, which is a good thing, I think, going forward.
How rare is GIST in terms of overall prevalence? And in general, how familiar are healthcare professionals with the disease?
So that gets to the story of how we know how many patients there are. So a long time ago in Western Sweden, a study was done. And that study looked at the incidence and prevalence of GIST amongst other diseases. And what they found was there are 14 people per million in that population who had that disease. So somebody basically said, well, Western Sweden, the United States, they're very similar. So I guess in the United States, 14 per million is as good a number as any. When I used to tell that story years ago, I hadn't been to Sweden. And I'd say, well, I've never been to Sweden, but I imagine it's not exactly like the United States. I've since been to Sweden, and I can confirm that while it's a wonderful country for all our Swedish listeners, it is not the United States. And the ethnic backgrounds, the dietary backgrounds, all these other things are very different. So the reality is it's a guess. We believe, like we said, it's about 5,000, but estimates range from as low as 3,000 to as high as 10,000 newly diagnosed patients a year in the United States alone. Now, if you extrapolate that, in the LifeRaft Group's patient registry, which we've been doing for 20 years, the average patient lives for more than 10 years. So it is conceivable that there are 50 to 100,000 just patients walking around the U.S. right now. There may be more, there may be less, but that's a good estimate.
And how many of those 50,000 to 100,000 are aware they have the disease?
Those would be diagnosed patients. That's a whole nother thing. There are patients we found actually, and we get this from when people are die in a hospital and an autopsy is done. Many people have what we call microcysts, which are just less than 2 centimeters. And those just never evolve into full-blown cysts. We don't understand why that is. We're beginning to understand now. We used to say that if it just was under 2 centimeters, there's really nothing to worry about. But we've actually seen cases now where those just do actually extrapolate to become larger and more problematic. So that, you know, we know a lot about cysts, but there's still a lot left to learn. I always tell people when it comes to cancer, we know more than many other diseases, but that doesn't mean we know everything, not even close.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Life Raft group, a little bit about how it got started, and also why is it called the Life Raft group?
Interesting. So the Life Raft group, we always say, started with a love story. Okay. Our executive director, Norman Scherzer, he worked for many years for the CDC. At one point, he was assistant commissioner of health in New York City. And his wife, Anita, was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma back, you know, in the late 90s, I believe it was. It was very common back then for GIST to be misdiagnosed as leiomyosarcoma.
To be misdiagnosed as?
Leiomyosarcoma, which is another form of sarcoma with smooth tissue. It does present fairly similarly. One thing that is different, in many females, it's in the uterus, which we don't normally see with GIST. In terms of initial presentation, it can metastasize, but it rarely does. But it turned out that Anita did not have LMS, leiomyosarcoma, but instead had GIST. Norman realized this, and at that time, there was a drug in development. She had many rounds of traditional chemo. To realize that at that time, the response rate for traditional chemo for GIST was 5% or less. So basically, this was a disease with no treatment. Turned out, just luckily, that at that time, there was a drug in trial. It was called STI-571, which eventually became Gleevec that was approved. And Anita got in the trial, and she responded extremely well, as did many patients who literally walked out of their deathbeds. And Norman said, wow, we should probably form an organization for this, got together. And that happened, you know, in the early 2000s. And since that time, not only Novartis, who developed Gleevec, but all of the other drugs that have happened since then, and we're fortunate to have quite a few. We've worked with many of those companies, you know, to basically help after that drug was approved. But now at this time, we get involved well earlier than that in the early stages. So we are at heart, I'm the director of research, but we're at heart a patient advocacy organization that supports patients through education, through research, through outreach. We do all the things, we educate patients just like your website is doing for HCPs. And we also educate doctors as well, because you mentioned how common is it for a doctor to see GIST. The reality is, for the average community physician, not very common, once or twice in a career. We do work with a lot of GIST experts who see a lion's share of the patients. That is good if you're a patient, because you're going to someone that's very familiar with the disease. However, for the medical establishment in general, you know, if everyone's being seen by a handful of doctors, it doesn't help in terms of general medical population of getting people familiar. So at this point, we tend to have patients get routed to experts whenever possible.
How many drugs at this point are approved for GIST?
So that's a bit of a complicated question. So let me just get into it. In terms of for general GIST patients with no specific mutations, there's currently Gleevec from Novartis. There is Pfizer has Sutent, otherwise known as Sunitinib, and Gleevec has since gone generic. Pfizer has not yet. And then there is Stivarga or Regorafenib from Bayer. That's for the general population. Then when you get into specific submutation types, okay, and actually there's one other drug too that was recently approved, Ripretinib, now known as Qinlock from Deciphera, which is a pan-TKI that hits many, many targets, okay? There's another drug, though, after those, you get into very specific subtypes. So there is a drug called Avapritinib or Avakit that is made by Blueprint Medicines out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that is approved for a very specific mutation, the PDGFRA exon 18 D842V substitution mutation. which is very good because all of the other drugs that were approved before, except perhaps for ripretinib, it did not work against. Then there are two very specific drugs for an extremely rare mutation known as an NTRK fusion. In this case, NTRK and ETV6 end up having gene fusions. What I tell patients, I guess this will work for physicians, is think of a chromosome as pants and shirts, and they switched parts of the DNA. So you just switched pants with your neighbors and kept your shirt, or switched shirt and kept your pants. So part of the chromosome switch, and that would be Vitrakvi and entrectinib. These are exceedingly rare mutations. And those particular drugs, those last two for NTRK, are actually approved for the NTRK gene fusion, not necessarily for GIST, but for ultimately hundreds of diseases at once, of which GIST is one.
And I'm guessing that the rarer the subset of disease, the more expensive these treatments are.
Sometimes, yes. But what also is beginning to happen is because we're moving from location to mutation, sometimes what happens is you have something like GIST where you have a very rare subtype. Let me give you an example, BRAF, okay? BRAF in GIST represents not very many patients, but it is the driving mutation in melanoma, okay? So if you were to have a drug that was aimed towards melanoma and then probably off-label use, you would end up with using it for GIST, then that becomes an investigator-initiated trial where a doctor says, well, geez, this works, okay? Then it ends up being approved. And actually, all of our three first approved drugs, that's kind of how it happened. What you can take those drugs and divide them into two generations. The first generation would be Gleevec, Sutent, and Stivarga. And what happened there is all of those drugs were not developed exclusively for GIST from the beginning.
These are known as TKIs.
TKIs, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, because what...
Can you say that again more slowly?
Tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Now, a kinase means an enzyme. I'm sure our readers know that. But what's happening here is they are inhibiting these mutated proteins. So in the case of KIT, let's say, and this is probably true of all of them, think of it like, you know, cancer is just uncontrolled mitotic cell division, but think of it as a stuck gas pedal. So now you have two options. You can either cut the line or apply the brakes, okay? And what an inhibitor tries to do is come along and use an enzyme as a fake to say, hey, the enzyme is already applied. So you don't need to come by and put your helper enzyme in here to help that cell division continue. The fake enzyme's there. It's like you put a traffic cone in your parking spot to keep it. Eventually, this thing stops dividing. But unfortunately, eventually the body figures this out and goes, that's just a cone, I'm going to move it. So in it comes, and that's how resistance develops, which is why we have other drugs. Once a patient develops resistance to imatinib, they move on to the next line of drugs. These first three lines were developed with other diseases in mind. Gleevec was CML and then came GIST. Sutent was actually renal cell carcinoma and GIST at the same time. And Stivarga was developed for late stage colorectal cancer.
Peter, would you talk about the side effects of Gleevec and other TKIs?
Okay, so first off, all cancer drugs probably have three or four side effects that are pretty common, regardless of what they are. And those would be fatigue, diarrhea, muscle cramps, and I would probably say nausea would also fit into that. Anything you take is going to have those. So our patients report those with great frequency, but any patient on a cancer drug will probably report those. In addition to those, each of these drugs does have side effects that it's somewhat known for. And I want to be careful because that doesn't mean that they're not treatable or anything else. But Gleevec and chemo brain, you know, the idea of cognitive issues is something else that probably should get in that list.
You're talking about cognitive fog, that kind of thing?
Yes. And I want to distinguish that from straight up cognitive issues like cranial bleeding or embolisms. You know, this is, I've forgotten my keys, you know, things like that, which, let's be honest, I think I've done that this week. You know, so it's very hard. That's a very important point, because when you're talking about side effects, and this is a lot of the research the LifeRef group does, you have to ask yourself, is this due to medication? Is this due to disease? Or is this due to other factors? And it's not that simple to chain that out all the time. I always tell people that are on Gleevec and any other drug, if you come into a room and you can't remember why you came in there, okay, that could be stress, it could be a lot of things. But if you come into a room and you can't remember how you got there, Okay, now we're talking about cognitive issues, and that's where you really need to seek help. So for Gleevec, we see thinning of the skin, which happens, which makes you very susceptible to sunburn. We see what they call periorbital edema, or swelling around the eyes. It's almost the harbinger of Gleevec. You know, you go and you'll see people with Gleevec eyes. You then have, other issues that are variant by patient. Sutton.
I'm sorry, in your last webinar, for example, I recall the dentist who had to stop practicing dentistry because he had terribly painful hand cramping.
Which I would say happens not in the majority of patients, but it can happen. And when it does, in that case, for that patient, that was very severe. And now that goes even beyond what we would just call side effects to be a quality of life impact.
And it caused him to have to give up his
right. So quality of life, meaning it affects your sleep, it affects relationships, affects your work, affects all these other things. And one of the things we've learned at the LifeRaft group when it comes to side effects is, we rate them. Adverse events are rated on a scale. Like when you go into a clinical trial, our readers know from 1 to 5, 5 means death, 1 is okay, whatever. And you may have diarrhea 9 times a day, and that's not life-threatening, so it's 2. But you can't leave the house. You can't have a job. So now if someone were rating that on a quality of life scale, it might be a 9. And one of the things we learned early on is when patients collect data or patient groups collect data, it's not adversarial to the pharma data, it's complementary. You need to have context and say, yeah, this might be a 2 in a clinical trial setting, but this is really hurting the patient. And we've learned things like, for example, if you're going to take an anti-diarrhea medication, if you know that every morning you're gonna take your oncology medication and have a diarrhea event, well, then you probably should just take the diarrhea medication before taking the medication so you don't have the event, be preventative. And it's little things like that where everyone goes, yeah, no kidding, but, It does make sense, and that is where the patient perspective actually comes in. In terms of the other drugs with side effects, Sutton has a black box warning, actually, on its label for liver toxicity, but cardiotoxicity is an issue. Now, remember, when you get to these later stage drugs, one thing that's very important is often the patient has taken another drug for a long period of time. So if a patient starts taking Sutton, and then all of a sudden has, say, issues with their kidneys. Gleevec and long-term use seems to have had, I can't say it has an association yet because it hasn't been proven, but there seems to be an incidence of kidney issues for long-term users with Gleevec. So now that patient goes off of Gleevec, goes on to Sutton, has kidney issues. Patient was on Gleevec for 12 years, was on Sutton for 12 weeks. It's very hard to blame Sutton for those kidney issues. So you have to keep that context in mind. But that being said, cardiotoxicity issues, prolonged QT interval, these are all things that are in the PI, are known for Sutton.
When did Sutton come on the market?
Sutton came on the market in 2003.
Gleevec was already in the late 90s.
Maybe it was 2006. I think the trial started in 2003. Right. You look at that. But Gleevec was already on the market for a few years, yes.
Okay. And at that point, there were only 2 FDA-approved therapies.
Yes, yes. And for many patients, the only way to get that treatment for a while was in that trial. So, and then it becomes approved. I can definitely tell you that Stivarga was approved in 2013 because I was here at the LifeRaft group before that. We've also learned in our research that just the availability of those drugs actually helps prolong patient survival because it gives them another choice. If you look at the numbers, Gleevec performs unbelievably. When it first came out of the clinical trial, median progression-free survival at 24 months. We now have seen, and that's a huge number. I mean, because, you say, I'm saying that too. I'm so spoiled that when we look at ASCO or CTOS or these other events and someone's going, oh my God, we got 6 months of PFS on this drug. Isn't this amazing? And we're all like, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's what we have to realize is 24 months is a big number. And it's actually bigger than that because since we've gotten better at that point, it was 24 months. We're giving it to everybody, including D842V patients who didn't respond to it, people who had no mutation tests, wild type patients, whatever. Then we got better at this and started doing mutational testing on a larger scale, a thing the LifeRaft group is very much in favor of, and every GIST expert is, the numbers crept up. An EORTC study back in 2013, I believe, said now that median PFS was closer to 36 months. In our LRG registry, we've seen that it actually can approach as high as 5 years.
Is there an average age at which GIST, onset of GIST, you generally see?
Yeah, well, in our registry, the median age is about 58 years old. However, the range is quite Amazing.
And is there any prevalence among men or women, or it's about
so, so, okay, it depends which subtype of GIST you're talking about. In what I call general GIST, more non-specific, no, it affects people of all ages fairly equally. We've had newborns to 90-year-olds diagnosed, males and females about the same. However, the SDH-deficient variant, that is a whole nother disease. Yes, there's an oncogene often implicated, but succinate dehydrogenase is a tumor suppressor gene that there is a deficiency. That particular tumor suppressor gene is missing. And in that case, those patients have a very different presentation. Many of them, we used to say that it was all indolent in terms of disease. That's not true. There are some who are not indolent. We don't quite understand why some and others don't.
This is in the webinar, yes. The last speaker had SDH,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct. She had SDH deficiency.
And she was first diagnosed at the age of 16.
Right. So what happens when you get to SDH is the numbers flip. In regular GIST, mid, late 50s, whatever, males, females, equally, nothing. The tumor can mostly be in the stomach, but it can be in other places. When you talk about SDH deficient GIST, it's predominantly females, predominantly younger people. It almost always, but not always, presents in the stomach. Okay, so that is it's a different family of diseases, really, because the treatments are very different. Because again, and you can have that tumor suppressor gene deficiency. If you don't have an oncogene, that's fine. It's just sitting there. It's kind of like the idea of homozygous expression of disease. It's there, you're a carrier. And that is a good point, because SDH patients are more likely to pass the disease on to their offspring. So they need genetic counseling, as opposed to, it is very possible for any GIST patient to do that, but the incidence is much lower.
And also, if the average onset is at age 58, they're not having children at that point.
Well, you never know now, but yes. And that is, yes. However, the thing about numbers, statistics, is their averages, their medians, okay? And yes, the median onset of SDH is less, and they're more females. That does not mean males don't get the disease, and it does not mean that older people don't get the disease. We have seen patients in their 70s with SDH. Like I said, we used to say indolent growth, mm-hmm. but we've now noticed there are some more aggressive forms of it. And we have yet to understand, we're learning, why are some SDH forms aggressive and others indolent? We don't know. Now, in the case of Aaron, who's the person on the webinar you were mentioning, the other thing that's important with SDH is it actually gets implicated in a family of diseases known as either Carney's diet or Carney's triad. So once you have GIST, you also can have pheochromocytoma, or you can have an adrenal issue as well. So if you have all three of these, that's Carney's triad. If you have two of them, that's Carney's diet. What's important from not just the patients, but from a clinician perspective, is that implies a different treatment regimen than a standard GIST patient. And to make life complicated, because that's what we do, if you have, SDH has four complexes. We call them SDH A, B, C, and D, the enzyme. If any of them are broken, the whole thing doesn't work. It's like a stair. Whichever one you take out, you still can't get upstairs. But if the SDHC is taken out, there is and this could be true of any of them, but mostly SDHC, there is a possibility that what you have is actually an epi mutation. In that case, what's happening is an epi mutation, okay, which, let me get to why, because that's why it's relevant. You have hypermethylation in the molecule, okay, and I think our readers might know what that means. It means methyl groups, CH3 groups, are attached to the enzyme, which is why they can't bind. What's important there is you could use a demethylating agent to treat that patient. So again, these targets that we get, these mutations, are not just, hey, we gave you a number. It's because the treatments vary based on them. To us, what mutation you are is only important if it has clinical relevance. Okay, and in the case of GIST, what makes us a little different and a little more of a model is that not only do we have a lot of mutations, and we've had them for a long time, now everyone has these, but they're actionable. Okay, in many cases. And there are some that aren't, but every day researchers are looking for more targets to hit and those that aren't hit well to hit again, and synergistic targets hit multiple targets. We're beginning to try to understand how does resistance develop so we can forestall it. We've been looking at that for years, but I think we're honestly getting closer.
Can you speak in general terms about what LifeRaft Group does mm-hmm. as an advocacy group for GIST patients and also as a member of NORD?
Absolutely. So it kind of goes back to our mission. What we do for patients is advocacy. So the biggest thing I think we do with patients is inform them. You, as a patient with a rare disease, and rare cancer in particular, have to become very informed about your disease because everything that's going on out there, especially if you're not with a GIST expert, one of the things we communicate is the need to get to a GIST expert. But so education is very important. That's keeping patients up to date about all the different medications that are available now and maybe available in the future, how to treat their side effects, because the thing about side effects is they become debilitating enough that you can't be adherent to your medication. That's going to result in progression. Providing hope to patients that even if you do have progression, there are other treatments down the line. Okay. We do also, what makes us different is our holistic approach. In addition to that education for patients, which lots of groups do, there's straight up advocacy, where when patients are having difficulty getting access to a drug or getting into a clinical trial, we will try to intervene whenever possible. And we do this globally. So in countries, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to work with, but we do. We also have research, of course, and that's what I do. And our research, yes, we do sponsor outside researchers, absolutely, but we also do our own research. Given the patient registry data we have and looking at different combination of treatments and how well they do, we often work with the industry to help them understand that information. But we also do kind of a different form of outreach. Not only do we outreach to patients, but what started to happen in the last few years, we used to take our data and go to pharma and say, hey, you need to look at this. You need to look at this. Now they're coming to us early on and saying, we'd like to see what you have. You know, because instead of saying, hey, a trial, we've done it already. We've already set it up. By the way, we're having a problem recruiting it. Can you help us? This is, we'd like to do a trial. We'd like to talk to you to figure out the best way to structure this so we'll have a better chance of recruiting. And then also, once the drug's approved, we provide support to patients. And that can be many things. That can be emotional, that can be financial, that can be all kinds of stuff.
Okay, I'd like to wrap up with a subject that's been on everybody's minds for the last year and a half, and that's COVID. Everybody's talking about it. It seems that with over 600,000 deaths in the United States, despite that horrible number, it seems that we're finally pulling out of this pandemic. However, for cancer patients and, of course, rare cancer patients, their immunity is compromised by the drugs they're taking. And I'm wondering if you can talk just briefly about how GIST patients have borne the brunt of this pandemic.
So, okay, so that's two different things, and it's very interesting. What's ironic is, you know, a year and a half ago, I talk about COVID time now. The beginning of the pandemic seems like about 100 years ago, okay? But yeah, about a year and a half ago. And I remember early on where we literally had people coming to us and saying, it looks like imatinib might prevent COVID, okay? We actually had that discussion happening, and there was the idea of that these TKIs had preventive effects. Doesn't necessarily, I'm not to say that's not true, but it doesn't look like it is. We didn't have any conclusive evidence to say that. We started to see that patients who were on Gleevec did not get COVID. However, I think what we learned over time is that cancer patients are very, very good at lockdown because they've been doing it most of their lives. Now, that doesn't mean there were not effects for patients, okay? So in terms of the actual COVID itself, we did not have an epidemic of patients coming down with COVID. There were a handful who did. Many of them were not on treatment. However, COVID impacted the entire medical industry in an extensive way. There are negative ways and there are actually positive ways. The negative way was, especially in the very beginning, a lot of people had to push their appointments. We will not know for a long period of time whether the push, now you're not going to get your CAT scan this year, you're going to get it next year. Did they have progression? We'll find out. So that's still to be determined. However, I always like to be a glass half full kind of guy, because when you're dealing with cancer patients, it keeps your soul in the right place, okay? But one of the advantages is telemedicine has come, and it is staying. So now, if you live in Montana, which is beautiful, but you don't have access to a GIST specialist anywhere nearby, you're literally an iPhone or Android phone call away. And we've had a number of physicians, key physicians in the GIST community, step up and say, we will offer telemedicine consults. Working with other physicians, working with patients directly, whatever, I know it's complicated, but you know, this is an emergency, so we did that. So that's a positive. In terms of the impact on how has it impacted patients from a progression standpoint and whatever, we don't know yet. I think we're going to see that in another year or so. I will tell you that there were clinical trials that were going and they continued to go. We didn't see clinical trials fail to recruit due to COVID. They, in some cases, were stalled a little bit.
Yeah.
Clinical trials take a really long time.
So. What about vaccines? Have there been any particular concerns for GIST patients?
No. Remember, too, GIST patients are humans like everybody else, and they have comorbidities. So there are patients who will have medical issues, comorbidities, that would prevent them from taking the vaccine. In that case, they shouldn't. But in the case of GIST, there is no contraindication at this point. As a matter of fact, there's many things that would say a cancer patient, if they can tolerate, should take that vaccine. And that has been the general consensus of the sarcoma medical community. Again, we don't know what the infection rates are, so TBD.
Peter, thank you very, very much for your time. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.